underground bunker of the Civitas studio in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence, at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax, but buckle up, and let's wade into the deep end of what's really happening in your old North State.
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. I'm here with my bestie, my good friend, Brooke Medina. We're going to talk a lot of stuff today. We're going to talk traffic safety, caravans coming up from Central America through Mexico to our border, early voting, large family bias, and Trump's visit to Charlotte. How are you doing, Brooke? How's it going?
It's going great. And yeah, it sounds like we've got a lot to talk about this week, Ray. But first, let me ask you, how are things going? Because pretty soon you guys are about to welcome another baby.
Yep. Henry is on his way this week sometime soon. So we're really excited about that. It's almost like one kid is so much work. So I'm trying to get my head around. I don't think reality has sunk in for how much two kids, how much work that is. You would know. You have four kids.
Yeah, reality's about to hit you like a ton of bricks, my friend.
See, I feel like I can sometimes slough off my son to my wife, you know, and be like, but now with two kids, it's
going
to be harder to hide, right, in the
house. You can't hide. No, you cannot. That is correct. So I remember when I had our second child, my husband was actually gone at the time as well because he's in the military, so he's out of school. And so the first couple of weeks with having the second child, it was just all a blur to me because I was so tired. It was just me kind of solo parenting.
Yeah.
And I was shocked just with, you know, trying to balance everything. But then we neutralized, we found our happy place, and things went smoothly from there. However, yeah, the first couple weeks are pretty like shell-shocked, and I'm sure you're going to be coming into the office and you're probably going to like have a twitch or something like that and
I'm
be
sure.
Very sleepless.
Kids are great, but they're a lot of work, and I love singing to my son at night now. He really is, it's one thing that helps him fall asleep. So it's like those times are the rewarding times, but I'm not a morning person, so I really have to adjust to getting up and getting geared up to help out kids in the morning because I'm in a pretty bad mood, and I'm just not, you know, that into it.
Well, babies are sometimes in a bad mood in the morning, too.
Yeah.
So there you go.
So I'm kind of like a baby in some ways. It's very true.
Ray, what Ray's trying to say is he's a baby.
Yeah.
So.
I don't drink coffee, so that's one of my excuses.
Okay. Well, let's I know you wanted to talk about traffic
safety.
Yeah, I just
have a gripe to pick a little bit. I don't know if this is a North Carolina thing. It didn't seem to be as bad when I was living in Mississippi. Maybe not quite as bad when I was living up in Grand Rapids. But people drive so fast in residential neighborhoods, particularly my neighborhood, and it's starting to get a little irksome. I mean, we have a speed limit of 25 miles per hour. I think there's times people are going over 50 miles per hour. And it's not even teenagers anymore. It seems to be like adults with their own kids. And it's just starting to irritate me. You know, I know that there's been a couple people in our neighborhood that has complained, called law enforcement. And I see this. My wife texted me this morning. Someone right outside of our neighborhood has flew into a ditch because I know they were going around a corner way too fast. So you have people pulling out. That speed limit there is like 55 miles per hour once you leave our neighborhood. I think it's way too fast. Anyways, please slow down in residential neighborhoods. I just don't understand the idea of putting people at risk. It's not. It almost seems like it's not even safe to walk.
Yeah.
I don't know what your thoughts are on that are, but people are just driving recklessly in residential neighborhoods, like rolling through stop signs really fast. And it's not even safe to get out and walk, I feel like, sometimes. It's starting to just bother me.
Well, I'm one of those ladies that will yell from my yard if I see someone driving by real fast, and I'll yell at them to slow down. And I've got a sign that says, drive like your kids live here, and things like
it's
that.
It's getting
I don't
bad
mess around.
When you like daydream about putting an IED in the street or something because you know people are driving so fast.
There you have it, folks. That's how Ray feels about this, quite strongly, it seems. So.
It just really bothered. I just don't understand the concept. And then I know the FedEx trucks and the UPS trucks are trying to hit tight deadlines and they get so many orders from Amazon and whatnot, but they're also
flying. One of the worst offenders.
They're some of the worst offenders.
Yes.
But also in our neighborhood, and I don't know, I haven't reported them yet, but there is a school bus that I swear was on two wheels today because it took a turn so fast. And I'm looking at this guy. He's done it before. He drives recklessly in that school bus, and I'm surprised that the parents, my kids are too young to ride a school bus, but I'm surprised that there's not more parents complaining because I see him screaming through our neighborhood in the school
goodness.
Bus. It's
That's
insane.
That's crazy. Yeah.
Anyways.
So, y'all be those kind of drivers that you want others to be like when you've got kids playing outside, and also don't hesitate to be one of those cranky folks that like yells and waves your newspaper at the fast drivers from your front yard while you're in your pajamas and like yell at them to slow down, because our kids' safety is worth it, and I don't really want to get hit by a car either, so there's that.
I have actually been hit, not hard, but just sort of crossing in traffic. A lot of people don't understand crosswalks in North Carolina either. I think that's a more of a nationwide problem, that people don't understand crosswalks, but I've been walking around Raleigh a few times and just, well, I'm at a crosswalk. I mean, I'll look, but I'll also exert myself a little bit, and I don't really do that as much anymore because you're bound to get hit.
Yeah, you got to be real careful.
So what's going on, Brooke, with these caravans that are coming up from Central America, Honduras mainly, coming to the border? I see Trump talking about it, that he's going to exert his sort of power and authority as president to stop this. I mean, how much of a crisis is this? Does this seem a little bit manufactured by the media? What are your thoughts on this?
So I was not tracking previous migrant caravans, although I have heard some commentators say that, you know, this has happened before. It happens from time to time. It's just right now, when we're in this election season and things are pretty tense, it is getting more traffic and more eyes on it than previously. However, this is one of, if not the largest migrant caravan in recent history, according to something I read earlier today. So I know I read 7,500 migrants are in this caravan, according to CNN. I think you read another number, all the way up possibly to 14,000.
And there's a second caravan that there may be, I guess, some members of the media or people on the ground were interviewing people that had already been deported from the U.S. Mm-hmm. So I think I saw that in one NBC story.
Right. So I think it's, there are some people on the right who are like, send them all back. Yeah. I even saw one tweet that said, shoot them, which I thought was horrible.
That seems horrible.
I am definitely a, someone that believes in enforcing our immigration laws. Unfortunately, we're not enforcing the laws we already have. So we think our immigration system is broken. Well, part of that is because we're not enforcing the laws we actually have. And there's a lot of bureaucracy. I have a couple of people, friends and family members that have immigrated here from other parts of the world. And to see what they go through to get their green card, it's insane. I mean, all the hoops and all the paperwork, all the money, there needs to be a better way to handle this. But but when it comes to those that are coming here from this southern border, I think that there's a number of factors. I know the president said some were from the Middle East. I don't think that's been confirmed yet, so it'll be interesting if they provide evidence for that. But Brandon Darby, he is someone that actually has, I believe, had a previous relationship with Civitas, and he has spoken in the past to Civitas audience, and I was looking at his Twitter because he works right there on the border and does a lot of research when it comes to immigration and illegal immigration, and he said, a significant issue is that migrants seeking asylum from the South often have to go through the same cartel territories and receive the same treatment as do people trying to sneak in. So there's a difficulty in separating those that are here because of economic reasons, those fleeing from a horrible, dangerous conditions, and they're trying to protect their family. And then there's those that would just try to come in here and infiltrate with dangerous, like, you know, gang members and things like that. MS-13 is a problem in certain areas of the state or the country. But Brandon Darby continues and says, people seeking asylum and those trying to sneak in have to pay Mexican cartels to get here. Yep. They often are put into indentured servitude or sexual slavery to pay back the cartels, or their families will get murdered. As these groups go through the cartel territories, some estimates indicate up to 70% of migrant women from Central America get sexually assaulted in the process of getting here.
Right.
This applies to people seeking asylum and people trying to sneak in. And then he finishes up, many U.S. media outlets only mostly focus on what happens to asylum seekers once they are in custody or have interaction with border security, but this is only 5% or so the reality. The other 95% of their experiences are ignored, and there are consequences to this. Most people who think we shouldn't allow large numbers of migrants to come here in this way aren't being hateful or racist. It's because they realize that allowing it encourages more and perpetuates some of the most horrible brutalities happening in our hemisphere.
Right. That's a good point. I think that's a good point, Brooke. I mean, the money that some of these folks have to pay to coyotes, and like you said, the services that that they're forced to undergo, indentured servitude, and just lack of, I think, just basic decorum in treating somebody like a human is such a big deal. I mean, I took a Latin American politics class in college, and I just remember reading about some of these coyotes and people that would, you know, the amount of money you'd have to pay to get smuggled across the border, the amount of abuse, like you mentioned, sexual assault. Those are all things that I think we have to pay attention to. And, you know, I think for me, just kind of like watching this story in real time, I think one of the things that concerned me a little bit is like some of the media was showing pictures of mainly just women and children. But I've also seen photos that look like, hey, most of them are like 20, 30-year-old males. And so that, to me, is a little bit more concerning. Not that they, you know, don't have the same sort of abuses and are facing the same sort of corrupt government that that everybody else is facing down there. But it just makes me wonder a little bit sort of the angle with some of these migrants. With any sort of movement, you're going to have a lot of people hanging on or clinging on that are, you know, obviously we don't want them in this country. You know, from me looking at it just from a big picture perspective, we're a nation of borders. We're a nation of a rule of law. And I think that we have to be serious about this in this day and age. When we have terrorism, when we have the sort of threats to our national security that are unlike situations that we've had in the past. And so I think it's just one thing I'll give Trump credit for is he's been pretty firm on these issues of illegal immigration. And no president has really done that before.
Yeah.
Not in modern times, at least.
They've issued platitudes, but they haven't actually had some actions. And if you're the executive of the nation, you have the ability to enforce some of these things. So, you know, how serious were previous presidents? I do think that Trump has made some progress when it comes to this, at least moving the dialogue further than we have previously.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And I agree. I think that that's a good thing. He talks about merit-based immigration. I think that there is a lot to be said about that. Some people do not agree with
most
that.
Most nations
but I think,
do that.
So, yeah.
I mean, that's not anything.
That isn't anything new, but by the sounds of it from some people when you listen to it, you hear that they think that that's a horrible, horrific thing, and they have a difficult time understanding merit-based immigration. But I think that that there is something to be said about that under certain conditions. Again, immigration, it's a messy issue.
It really
is
a messy,
nuanced,
and complicated, nuanced.
Yeah,
all those things.
But I do think that there needs to be a discussion around chain migration, immigration, or family immigration and merit-based. I think that you can even have both of them, but not one at the expense of the other either. So anyways, we've got some comments here on Facebook. Someone said, who organized the whole fiasco? That's a good question. I know I read a name on the CNN article. I'll have to see if I can find that later on again, and I will share that. But it was just one individual that was considered the organizer of this, but I didn't recognize the name.
I've seen a lot of people talking about George Soros as being an organizer. I haven't seen any evidence of that. If someone does have evidence that they think is valid, definitely post that in our comment section because I'd like to read that. I mean, I see a lot of tweets or people on Facebook saying Soros doing this, Soros doing that. Soros has almost become a catch-all for a lot of
things, I mean, Soros is like the boogeyman, just like the Kochs are the boogeyman for the left.
Right.
But here's another comment. So how do you stop them? I mean, if 7,000 people rush the border, the only thing that will stop them is force. I get that, but I'm wondering if 7,000 people are actually going to rush the border or if they're going to stand there and wait and demand and create this sort of
international crisis.
And in which case, there's going to have to be some, the White House is going to have to figure out how to respond to that. But anyways, it's a difficult situation.
It's a powerful reminder, I think, to reform our immigration laws, allow more people to come here as guest workers, give more people access to the market, the job market. I don't think any of those things are bad. We need to know who's coming into the country, where they're at, what they're doing. I think all those things are valid. I'm all for humanitarian stuff. I mean, I think one of the great things about this nation is that we took so many people from Cuba during, you know, the evils of the Castro regime that's still going on in Cuba. But I mean, we saw so much migrant. Sometimes Castro would empty the jails and undesirables, and we took a lot of those people in. And a lot of those people, some of those people are productive citizens today. And there's been a great, throughout Cuba, great tradition of just immigrants who've come here to escape communism. Other parts of Vietnam is a great example. So I'm all for taking in people who are escaping horrendous situations. But we need to know who's coming here and why they're coming here.
Yeah, I agree. My father-in-law is actually an immigrant from Ecuador, and he moved over here and is definitely somebody who contributes and it stays very civically involved.
That's funny. A lot of Americans are leaving for Ecuador.
Yeah, so I've heard. Yep. But my father-in-law came here, and I'm glad he did because that obviously gave me my baby daddy, my husband. So anyways, but let's switch gears because we do need to talk about, and I think our audience would be interested in hearing some of the information coming out of our early voting vote tracker. CarolinaElections.com is a website that is produced by Civitas Institute, and it is a fascinating way to just give you insight into how people are voting in the election. So, Ray, can you give us a little bit of analysis on that?
Sure. I think one of the main things that, just from a big picture perspective, is Republicans are outperforming Democrats in early voting. They've closed the gap. For some reason in North Carolina, you may know more about this than I do, Brooke. But Democrats tend to do very well in early voting in North Carolina. Republicans tend to show up on Election Day. I'm someone who actually shows up on Election Day. I don't get into all this early voting stuff. But I've looked at some of the numbers just nationally, and this may be pointing to that the blue wave's being a little bit overblown, but nationally, Republicans are up in early voting in a lot of states, especially some of these swing states like Florida, Nevada, Arizona, South Dakota. Republicans, where especially where these competitive Senate races are, they're up. They're outperforming Democrats. In North Carolina, they're closing the gap on the deficit. So that's just sort of the big picture. I know that this is going to be a high turnout election. It's going to mirror a presidential election more so than a midterm. I mean, I just read an article in U.S. News World Report that said in the last midterm elections, the national turnout for registered voters was 37%. That was pretty low. It was kind of a historic low. Now, the lowest will be at 44%, but it's probably going to be somewhere between 44 and 55%. That's the estimate from some of these early voting numbers that we're getting. That can always change, so that's a little bit fluid, but it looks like it's going to be no lower than 44%. So you have a host of things going on, Trump crisscrossing the nation, probably getting people out on the left because they hate Trump, and then getting out people getting out on the right because they're being energized by Trump. Trump's doing a good job, whether you like him or not, I think of nationalizing this election to some degree, which is probably smart because he's more popular than Pelosi. He's more popular than Schumer. He's more popular than Congress. He's a few more points popular than Obama was in 2010 during the midterm election. So there's a lot of advantages that Trump has in terms of nationalizing this election to some degree. So I think he'll continue to do that. He'll actually probably take more of the credit or blame if he loses and credit if he wins. So, you know, he's fundamentally transforming the Republican Party and his image in many ways through this midterm because, you know, you got everybody kind of kissing his ring. Ted Cruz in Texas was one example. This is going on all over the nation, people getting close to Trump. His popularity is on the rise. So, but the early numbers tend to favor Republicans. Indiana's another state that has a very tight Senate race. Republicans are outperforming Democrats there in the early voting so far. I mean, a lot of the numbers are early, but we'll continue to watch them, and you can go to our vote tracker.
I put it on our Facebook for the Facebook Live audience. And if you are not on Facebook Live, just go ahead and you can go to CarolinaElections.com.
Right. And Donald said something about, was it North Carolina 13? Was really, really surging for Republican votes, even more than normal, which is a pretty conservative district.
Yeah.
So Ted Budd may have a big advantage from that.
Yeah. Well, now I see another question here. Someone said, what do you mean by Republicans are outperforming Democrats? I think what you were saying was that right now, Republicans percentage wise are showing up at a greater rate than the Democrats were when we compare this year's
2016.
To 2016 or 2014.
I think both, but 2016 particularly.
Yeah. So if you look at the vote tracker, there's just some interesting information.
Now, Democrats did make some gains. I think it was on Monday. If there was early voting yesterday, they made some gains yesterday. So they did outpace. They have the lead North Carolina. It's kind of interesting to me, North Carolina, just so many. There's a lot more registered Democrats, of course, than Republicans in North Carolina. But even though we're kind of tilt conservative with our voters here, but it's interesting to me that Republican voters seem to have such a big lead in early voting nationally, but in North Carolina, it slips behind so much.
Well, don't you think at least at the national level, and we'll see what happens with North Carolina. Again, we're just making some early projections. We'll see if we're right.
Yeah.
We'll just keep watching.
I think it's hard to say with any prediction just because of the level of turnout is going to be so high.
But the Kavanaugh effect, like, do you think there is a Kavanaugh effect Republicans?
I do think there is. I mean, there was a midterm poll that just came out the other day. It was NBC, Wall Street Journal, and we have some polling at Civitas on this issue you can check out. But it said in swing and lean districts that they did polling in all those congressional districts, and Kavanaugh confirmation support was 43% compared to 33% against. So it's definitely helping Republicans. I think the big question is, how much will it help? How many people are going to vote one way because of that, or is it going to help them turn out to the polls because of that? So it's certainly helping from a polling standpoint, but it just depends on how many people will say, well, I'm voting this way because of Kavanaugh, or if they vote at all.
Right, yeah. So it's interesting to see what is energizing voters, which party seems more energized, what impact unaffiliated voters are contributing to this, because unaffiliateds in some ways lean more conservative, although they are termed unaffiliated. Obviously, they're still not a monolithic group. That's why they go by unaffiliated. But it does seem like, according to our last unaffiliated poll, they were far more conservative when it came to certain policy proposals.
Absolutely.
Solutions.
Yeah, on the policy side, they're more conservative.
Yeah. So anyways, very, very interesting stuff to be sure. So we'll keep covering that. But I think it's I wanted to talk a little bit about this Twitter hashtag going around. And it's kind of a smaller thing among that kind of is more popular among the Catholic and evangelical communities. But I think it has national and international implications. It's called Postcards for Macron, Macron being the president of France. His name is Emmanuel Macron. And I think it was last week he was speaking in Africa and he was saying, I always say, present me the woman who decided being perfectly educated to have 7, 8, or 9 children. So this was during a speech in Africa. He was talking about the need for education for young African women, which I think all of us can agree with. You know, it's just an important aspect for women to be able to have access to the same education that men are in certain parts of the world. That is just something that is more of a challenge right now. And so certainly a laudable thing. But a lot of women, especially educated women that have larger families, heard his statement about presenting me with a woman who decided voluntarily to have children or a large family, even though they're perfectly educated. And it seemed to Macron that that just didn't add up and it didn't make sense. Well, that got a number of women who do have large families to send Macron a message and let him know that there are actually plenty of ladies that and men that choose to have large families, even though they have, you know, advanced degrees. And so it was started by a woman that I have met named Catherine Pikolic. Have you ever heard of her, Ray?
I don't think so.
Catherine Pikolic, she's an economist, and I've actually spoken one-on-one with her. She's an incredible woman. I think she has 7 children now, and she works with Acton Institute on a lot of things. And so she decided to post a photo of her and her family on her graduation day with her gown and cap on. And it was just, it was a good message, but then a lot of other women, it gained steam, and a lot of other women hopped on this bandwagon and tried to send Macron a message. But from that story, Ray, what are your thoughts on this sort of false dichotomy that women should choose between career and having a large family, or having a large family necessarily means that people don't know how kids are made or something like that? What are your thoughts on all that?
I think it's just sort of an indicator of not just the illiberalism of our society to some degree, but we live in this post-agricultural society, right? So we put up this heavy value on, you know, lower, smaller size families, which I think is unfortunate because just the joy that children bring and how much of a blessing that they can be. You know, I used to be one of those people like, I'll only have 2 kids, that's it. And that may end up how it is. But I've also thought, you know, isn't it sort of selfish to sort of limit yourself into how many children you're talking about having or anything like that? So just, you know, life's such a blessing. So I take it from a very emotional perspective in terms of, it's offensive when people talk like this. And I think it comes from a place of ignorance and a place of, you know, we're in such a consumption society now instead of a producing society in many ways. We don't create as much anymore. And I think that has to do with life as well. But we just don't create like we used to. I mean, I just go back and think about the Baroque period and some of the great music that we were producing. We don't really produce music like that anymore. And we don't really produce as many in kids. I mean, that's one of the big things that we see in the suicide of the West or the death of the West is that we're not repopulating ourselves in many ways. I mean, the repopulation is coming from other areas of of the world. And some of that's very good, obviously. And to me, it just bothers me when people talk like that. I don't really know what else to say about it, but I think it comes from a place of ignorance. Of course, the culture tacks on and champions those sort of beliefs that, you know, say you should only have 1 or 2 more kids at most for environmental sustainability and things like that.
Yeah, well, that's already been debunked. That's Malthusianism, right? I mean, so Thomas Malthus many, many years ago stated that the world, there would not be enough resources on the earth to sustain society. You may have already also heard that idea espoused by Thanos from the Avengers.
Exactly. And what is Emmanuel Macron talking about? He doesn't even have any kids, I don't think.
No, he does. He has 2 children.
Oh, he does have kids?
Yeah, but he said it. Wait, no. I'm thinking Trudeau.
Isn't his wife like 20-something years older than him?
Macron does not have any children.
His wife's like 25 years older than
him. Yeah, she was his teacher at one time. She was his teacher. I actually researched that a little bit more. I thought it was pretty fascinating. It's interesting. But
teachers love the kitties now. They do. Have you been reading those stories, bro?
Sadly, I have. Sadly, and as a mother, it makes me really sick and mad.
It is. It's very disgusting.
But
All my teachers were like 90-year-old women, so.
There's this birth dearth, and that's what you spoke about. And it is that we are below replacement birth rate already. So I think that that's actually an interesting point when we're talking about immigration as well, because there are families from Central and South America that do have larger families. And so that might be something that we need to think about when we're talking about immigration as well, because if we're going to continue this massive welfare state in the United States and continue
to expand
it,
has done, right?
How are we going to pay for it?
That's what Europe has done, and they're paying a price for that with some of the radicalism that they've had in their own countries. I mean, just go out and read some of the dissenters in Europe who have not said that some of this mass immigration hasn't been good for the country. So,
yeah.
I mean, fortunately, we're not in the same situation as Europe, is taking some of those same immigrants. To be honest, not politically correct maybe, but I'd rather have more immigrants from Central America and Mexico than certain parts of the Middle East. And, Europe hasn't had the privilege of being so selective because of their welfare state.
So there's a lot around this conversation of family size and things like that. I think it's interesting. It would be neat to explore more. If you have a comment on this, or you have a large family and you want to speak into this, or maybe you come from a small family or chose not to have children, shoot us an email, radio@nccivitas.org, and give us your perspective on Macron's statements and things like that. We'd be curious. And if you're on Facebook Live, feel free to post a comment there. But I think we're almost out of time, but let's cover this last topic, which isn't President Trump coming to visit?
He's coming to Charlotte on Friday. I would assume to campaign for the North Carolina congressional district races that are tight, and also Mark Harris, who's right up against that district. So
yeah, and that's a close race. So
it's very close.
A lot of people are projecting that the Democrats are going to take over the House. Yep. And so there are some key battlegrounds, or there are some key battle elections in North Carolina when it comes to Congress. Excuse me, I'm having a hard time talking. But one of them is Mark Harris and Dan McCready. And Dan McCready is kind of a more moderate Democrat, or that's how he is presenting himself. And Mark Harris is a pastor, and he's a Republican candidate. And so it sounds like Trump is going to come over here and have a rally in Charlotte, maybe similar to the one in Texas, but to a smaller degree, since it's for a congressman, not a senator. I don't know how that plays into it. But what are your thoughts on him coming?
I think, like I said earlier, I think Trump is smart to sort of nationalize this election. He's making a referendum on him. His popularity is going up. And look, he really doesn't have much of a choice, because when Pelosi takes over as Speaker, and she probably will, they're just going to investigate him, ad nauseum. The Democrats will probably overreach, and so maybe it'll help Trump win re-election in 2020. But, I mean, his whole agenda is going to be stymied and stalled once Democrats take over the House of Representatives, which is very likely, I feel like. But it's not a foregone conclusion. That's why Trump's out there fighting. He's being very aggressive. Mobs, not jobs. I mean, he's talking about the Democratic Party is moving too far left. And so I think he's got an effective message out there, but it would just be a matter of, you hear the Democrats talking about, well, he's going to turn off suburban women, or there's just going to be this giant wave of Latinos that are going to come to the polls and sink him. But that didn't happen in 2016 either. So some of that identity politics, I don't know if that's going to ring true for the Democrats, even in the midterm elections. But
especially with jobs as well, good as they are right now, the job economy among minorities, I don't know if that's hurting him at all.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he'll do well among those populations per se in a midterm election, because he's not even on the ballot. But I do think that I think just some of his messaging has been effective, and he's got several things coming together for him. I mean, you've had the Kavanaugh hearings, you've got these mass wave of migrants coming from south of our border, and that could in turn help nationalize some of this election for him and really get out there and show he's kind of tough and that he's in charge. And, obviously there's going to be a lot of people that hate him. But I think in some ways, the more Trump's attacked, I think some ways he gets a little bit more powerful, because it riles his base up. And his base, they don't go out and necessarily publicly defend Trump in the public square, but when they see him get attacked, they show up to the polls. And I think Democrats are in jeopardy of that happening again if they get too aggressive and just sort of attacking Trump, which they always do. I mean, for them, I think it's almost better to run local elections and play up some of the issues that they have advantages on, instead of harping about Trump nonstop, because what it's going to do is rile up certain people on the right. And I think he's got a lot of effective energy the way he goes out in campaigns. I mean, the guy's, 70-something years old, and he goes out and campaigns like he's 30-something years old.
He's on some good energy pills or
something. He definitely has some energy. I mean, and he loves the campaign. He loves the adulation, and he loves getting out there and mixing it up with people. That's when he's at his best. I mean, a lot of people said he wasn't going to become president when he ran in 2016. But when I saw some of the size of the rallies at the end, I still thought Hillary would eke out an electoral win. But I thought he had a chance because I just remember that last night he was in Grand Rapids. And, you know, I recognized the neighborhood that the downtown area was in. And then the line just streamed for, I mean, it seemed like miles. And yeah. So he's very popular when he's on the campaign trail.
That he is. So anyways, that's it for this week on the radio program. Thank you so much for joining us on CivitTalk as well as on Facebook Live.
We appreciate
you.
So
we will catch you all next week. So, and if you're on Facebook Live, stay tuned. We'll talk a little bit more.